When I quit drinking, I was so suicidal because I was like, that's the only thing I love doing, going to bars. I loved it. So I was like, now I'll do comedy because I said, I have nothing to fear. That's my biggest love of my life is gone, drinking. I have nothing to lose.
Hi, I'm Maya Bialik. Welcome to my breakdown. This is the place where we break things down so that you do not have to.
It's Maya Bialik's breakdown. She's gonna break it down for you, because you know she knows a thing or two. So now she's gonna break down. It's a breakdown. She's gonna break it down.
Maya Bialik's breakdown is supported by Athletic Greens.
We love Athletic Greens over here. I like Athletic Greens because I'm the kind of person who used to take a gazillion, million, 100,000 pills.
That's the scientific number.
It's giving me heartburn. What is Athletic Greens? One delicious scoop of Athletic Greens means you're absorbing 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food source superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens to help start your day right. It's lifestyle friendly, which I love because I'm vegan and a lot of times things like this are not. AG1 is a small micro habit with big benefits. It's a thing you can do every day to take great care of yourself.
Right now, it's time to reclaim your health and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition. It's just one scoop in a cup of water every day.
To make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free one-year supply of vitamin D, which is super important for your immune system and so many things, and five free travel packs with your first purchase. Just go to athleticgreens.com/breakdown, athleticgreens.com/breakdown, to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance.
Mind Bialik Breakdown is supported by Air Doctor.
You are very excited about Air Doctor.
I'm going to admit something. I have purchased many air filters in my life, which is no surprise to Mime. From being exposed to like LA air and the forest fires that happen, I'm telling you, we got this thing and we turned it on. It is so quiet and I feel so much better. I can literally go into that room that it's in and feel a difference.
You do love it. A professional quality HEPA air purifier is recommended by leading medical experts as an effective way to reduce airborne germs and viruses and protect your home. Make sure you get an Air Doctor to keep you and your family safe this winter. Air Doctor comes with no questions asked 30-day money-back guarantee. If you don't love it, just send it back for a refund minus shipping. Go to airdoctorpro.com, use the promo code BREAKDOWN, and you'll receive a 35% discount on their classic Air Doctor 3000 purifier. That's right, 35% off, but only if you go to airdoctorpro.com and use the promo code BREAKDOWN. We've got a good one today. Very, very significant comedian, also an actor and an author, Colin Quinn. He is indeed one of the most beloved voices in comedy, but first, one of the most beloved voices in podcast world, Jonathan Cohen.
Maybe only in our podcast world, and there's only a 50-50.
I think you're beloved and beloved. Hello, Jonathan. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling pretty good, Mime. How are you today?
I'm excited to talk to Colin. I mean, I grew up watching him. I think he's very funny.
The comedian's comedian.
He is a comedian's comedian. He does a lot of theater. I mean, a lot of writing, a lot of his own kind of, you know, once he sort of left the SNL world, he's done so many things. He was on Broadway with Colin Quinn and Irish Wake and Long Short Story, which was also an HBO special. Colin Quinn Unconstitutional, which is on Netflix. The New York Story, which was directed by Jerry Seinfeld, also on Netflix. He also, in 2019, premiered Red State, Blue State. And that was actually adapted into a special that was, well, you can get it on Netflix, but it was CNN's first comedy special. And as we'll talk about with him, he's not a political comedian per se. He's a keen observer, you know, of patterns as comedians, you know, are and tend to be. But he's also had a very interesting path. And he's going to be actually doing a new show, Colin Quinn, The Last Best Hope, just wrapped a sold out New York City run at the Lucille, actually in November. But you can get tickets for Last Best Hope at colinquinn.com. And Jonathan and I are going to try and actually go. The world is shifting in that direction. So I would love to see that. Jonathan, do we have anything to tell our friends about?
Not really. I think they should just strap in, get ready for a good one.
Pull the bar down and give it a tug. Pull on the yellow thing now. Also, don't forget to follow us. Watching us is fun. I've got my shoulders out. Jonathan didn't mention it, but this has happened only once before. I'm letting them peek out.
Last time they came out, someone commented. They wrote me a message saying, oh, they flipped over from Spotify just to see the shoulders. It was a big draw.
Well, they're out again. So you can watch us if you subscribe to my YouTube channel. You can hit that little bell icon. Ding. And then you'll get notifications. Follow us on Instagram. We do a lot of fun stuff on Instagram, Bialik Breakdown. That's where Jonathan and I also do giveaways and little kind of special tidbits. We should do a live while you're remote. Jonathan's remote for this one. He's in Oregon. All right. So excited. Let's welcome Colin Quinn. Colin, welcome to The Breakdown.
Break it down.
I embarrassed you off camera, and now I'll do it formally on camera. I'm a very, very big fan of yours. I'm a very big fan of yours, and as someone who, you know, grew up really watching SNL as a lot of my kind of formative comedy, you were a very, very important part of an important part of kind of my life. I was born in 1975, so, you know, I was raised on reruns of The Best Years and then, you know, was part of, you know, getting to be an active watcher in some of The Best Years. And obviously you and Norm, a huge, huge component of that era. So
thanks, Normie boy.
I'm very excited to talk to you, to learn more about you. You know, I know kind of one type of aspect of Colin Quinn, but you have a, I don't want to say illustrative, but you have a very, very exciting other kind of part of your life, which is a lot of your kind of comedy and your theater life. And you have done many, many shows. I'm most curious about the one that you did. It's Colin Quinn and Irish Wake.
Oh, yeah. That's the one that never got filmed. Can you believe living in a world where you actually did something? And I even did it on Broadway for about a month and it doesn't get filmed. It was just at that line. It was 1998. And so, you know, the unions wouldn't let you film and you couldn't just film stuff, but that we have no copies of it. Isn't that the strangest thing ever?
I mean, maybe it will make a comeback now that everything is filmed. We could do it right in your living room.
If I pushed it, I'm sure I could, obviously I could do it. You know, if I remembered it and put it together and then I could film it and you could film it on my phone, you know?
Right. Okay, but let's go back a bit. I mean, our show is about, you know, mental health, mental wellness, but kind of, you know, people's journey. And I am curious a little bit for you to talk about what you came from. And, you know, for me, like anyone Irish is like, did you grow up like Angela's Ashes? Like, I read the book. I saw the movie.
I love Angela's Ashes, by the way. And I knew the McCourts.
Uh-huh.
Actually, Frank McCourt came to see Irish Wake and gave me this. He gave me one of the best compliments. And he hadn't put out Angela's Ashes yet. And I was just doing the show, but it was at the Irish Arts Center
right in
New York. And he came up to me afterwards. And I didn't know who he was, but he goes, I knew the McCourts. The other brother, Malik, he was more famous.
Right.
Like a roustabout guy on about town. He had a bar. And Frank McCourt goes, that was Shakespeare.
Oh, that's so amazing.
I know. It was a big, and then when I read his book, like his book came out like 3 years later.
Oh, he's, yeah. Like,
this guy's amazing. You know what I mean?
Okay, but it wasn't like that. So tell us.
It was middle class, Brooklyn, and you know, my parents are teachers and you know, we grew up in Brooklyn in the 70s. So there are a lot of typical is Irish stuff, but you know, intelligent. Like my family's smart, you know, like, and we read a lot, and Irish Wake was a combination of all of those, compilation of the Brooklyn, you know, growing up in that time.
You grew up in Park Slope, is that right?
In Park Slope, yeah. And it was a shifted neighborhood and a very, very wild neighborhood when I was a kid. Wild.
Yeah, well, those were some great and incredible times in New York. Jonathan always thinks that I'm a Brooklyn person because he's Canadian, so we forgive him. But my parents are from the South Bronx And they were born during World War II, so a very, very different time. My mother was raised in a tenement house, and my parents, you know, my mother was a native Yiddish speaker, you know, back when the Jews and the Irish were, you know, not allowed a lot of places. You know, usually when people hear that I have any accent, they assume Brooklyn. But Jonathan, can you tell the difference between how he talks and the way? Not so much. It sounds the same to you.
It's pretty close. Okay.
They're close. The difference is, to me, is that people in Brooklyn speak quicker, yep, and people in the Bronx cut off their words more than in Brooklyn.
Yeah, we'll review the Fred Armisen, you know, the different boroughs, the way that we talk in the different boroughs.
Does he do the boroughs?
Oh, he does all the boroughs, which is my favorite thing. It's my favorite thing.
I've seen him do every state, and I've never seen him do the boroughs.
No, he does the boroughs. Brooklyn.
He really is amazing.
Yeah, anyway. Okay, I won't do my Fred Armisen. So my parents were also teachers. What did your parents teach?
Yeah, all over, yeah. And everything, you know? I mean, yeah.
Did you have siblings?
Yeah, two sisters and a brother.
Wow, that's a big Irish family.
Yeah.
And were you always funny? I know it's a dumb question, but were you always a comedian or, you know, what?
Yes, I was a very boisterous, like I feel like a lot of comedians have ADD. So I definitely was one of, if there was such a thing back then, but there wasn't, but I was very scattered. I didn't like school. I was very just heckling. I was a heckler of teachers and, you know, I just hated it. I just hated everything. You know what I mean? I just was bored by it all. And it's not I hate when people go, I was bored because I was too small. And it's like, no, I was bored because I just had a bad attitude. I wasn't too smart. I didn't learn all those things. I didn't know all those things they were teaching already. You know what I mean? I just had a bad attitude.
Did your bad attitude continue like all the way through high school?
Yes, it continued actually until...
Till today. I still feel you got a bad attitude.
Probably like a year ago, maybe. Yeah. I mean, when I look back now, I'm like, oh my God. But I was just, you know, I didn't appreciate school. Put it this way. Now I look back and I'm like, oh, you idiot. All these great opportunities that you could have had and you chose to throw it away just because, you know, kids, when you're that age, you don't even care. People are telling you, you could say, I think back now, all the people that would be like, look, listen, this. And you're like, yeah, I'm going to do this. And it's like, no, you can't pick the worst of all the options, but you do. And I remember one time I was in high school and I was, you know, stoned all the time. And this guidance counselor, Mr. Berkowitz, comes up to me. And I'm in the library just sitting there like wasted, you know, like just high. This is the 1970s. Everybody's high. But this guy was a straight arrow. And he sat there and he goes, listen to me. You're such a personality. He goes, Colin Quinn, even your name. He goes, you should go to Wall Street and you become a big, like a sales guy. Colin Quinn. He starts imitating and he lays out this whole life. And he goes, and I go, I don't know. I think I want to be in like showbiz. He goes, but your wife can start a community theater later in Westchester. And you made up this whole ideal life. And I remember I told my mother about it. She goes, yeah, that's what he wanted. That's what he wanted
to
be. That's
right. That was his fantasy.
But it was a good fantasy. He goes, you'll be rich. He goes, you've got the personality. And I could tell he was like trying to give me like advice on what I should do. But I was like sitting there going like, but even whether it was that advice or good advice, it didn't matter. Teenagers don't listen to a word of advice. Most of them, you know, maybe there's a couple that do. I doubt it.
I got a 16-year-old who was born 65. He's always listens pretty much.
Oh, he does. Good.
It's very strange. But we're suspicious of him. We think he's Eddie Haskell.
Yeah. Or he might be one of those people that's just like, here's the way I do it. That's interesting. Thank you. That's really good. And yes, I do.
That's right.
Mind the Alex Breakdown is supported by Ritual.
Jonathan, what do I always say to you?
Stop doing that. Don't make jokes that are inappropriate.
Gaps in your diet shouldn't be ignored. Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin was formulated by exhaustive research to help fill nutrient gaps in the diets of women ages 18 and over. It's formulated with nutrients to help support brain health, bone health, blood health, and provide antioxidant support.
I was worried about you as a vegan not getting enough omega-3s in your diet.
Well, that's why I take my Ritual multivitamins, so that I am sure that I am getting my omega-3s and my vitamin D, which is critically important. And with Ritual, I know that it's in there. Ritual is committed to third-party testing from USP and the Non-GMO Project. They have traceable and vegan-friendly ingredients and always clear communication. No shady stuff. Right now, Ritual is offering our listeners 10% off your first 3 months. Where do they go, Jonathan?
Visit ritual.com/breakdown and turn healthy habits into a ritual. That's 10% off at ritual.com/breakdown. Mind the Alex Breakdown is supported by BetterHelp Online Therapy.
Relationships take a lot of work, especially the most important one that you have in your life. Not your partner, not your parent, not even your kid. It's yourself. What are some of the ways you can help yourself? Well, therapy. It's a big one for me. Exercise, eating right. Well, this month, BetterHelp Online Therapy wants to remind you that you matter just as much as everyone else does. And therapy is a great way to show up for yourself. My experience with therapy is that I don't want to live without it. It's not that I can't. It's not that I feel dependent on it. I have become addicted to taking care of my mental health. And I do that with therapy. BetterHelp is online therapy. They have video, phone, and even live chat sessions. You don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's more affordable than in-person therapy, and you're matched with someone in under 48 hours. Give it a try. See why over 2 million people have used BetterHelp Online Therapy. We're sponsored by BetterHelp, and our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/break. That's BetterHelp.com/break. What were the other things that you were interested in? So pot, obviously.
Pot, basketball. I mean, I really was kind of a, when I look back now, I go, I was relatively shallow. You know what I mean? I wasn't really interested in anything. I mean, I was just not interested in anything, but, you know, pot and basketball to a degree. I mean, even once I started smoking pot, I didn't even care about basketball. You know, I was a ball. I worked in restaurants. I like working in restaurants, you know, because, you know, it was exciting and everyone's out partying. I was really interested in the party. Like even when I used to watch stand-up comedy When I used to watch stand-up comedy when I was like 11 and 12, and I was like, look at this party. They're all smoking cigarettes. They're all smoke-filled rooms. They're laughing. They're drinking. It just, and my family parties were also a lot of smoking and drinking when the family would get together. So I was like, I like this. I like that. That just felt, that felt great to me, you know?
When did you start drinking? Was it kind of just all in that kind of party atmosphere?
Yeah, when I was like 15, 16. Yeah.
Okay. And you eventually stopped. Do you consider yourself a sober person, or you just don't drink, or you just don't like to? Like, where are you at with it as a grown-up?
Don't like to. Jesus. I mean, no, I quit drinking. I had no choice. I quit when I was 24. Wow. And I'm telling you, it was the last possible second. I was in all kinds of trouble. Mm. It was bad. Even the people in that, this is 1984. Even in those days, when nobody would even really think about that kind of thing.
Right.
People didn't want to hang out. My friends, nobody would hang out with me. I was one of those, you know. You see them once in a while. Well, you're like, oh, that guy, forget it. I mean, forget it. There was no way I was going to survive. I'd wake up in the middle of the street all the time, somewhere else, you know.
Obviously, there's a very strong, you know, literary and theatrical tradition of your people, of Irish people.
Yeah.
And often that is paired, you know, with a real need for whatever that is, you know, and alcohol is a depressant, you know, and
sure.
Yeah. I'm wondering, were you aware, like, at the time, what it kind of did for you? You know, like they say, first drinking is fun, then it's fun with problems, then it's just problems, right? What did it do when it was fun?
I was on the accelerated course. I wasn't one of those people that ever had the romantic period. I thought I was having it, but I was almost like, I was almost a bum when I was 20. I mean, I was sleeping in the Bowery sometimes. So I thought I had like this, I had like a frayed corduroy jacket, and I used to read J.P. Dunleavy, who had this drunken book. So I romanticized it myself, but nobody really, I wasn't fooling anybody myself. For a long time, you know, I just thought I was like a guy with a corduroy jacket, literary guy with a drinker. And I was reading the book, but I wasn't writing a book. I was reading a book. So obviously I had, what I thought was happening and what was happening were two different things. Common problem for everybody in life.
Right. Well, and I was going to say also, you know, for actors, like a stage is another place that we get to hide, you know, and I don't know what your, you know, childhood was like. I can, you know, speak for mine. My grandparents were immigrants and, you know, my parents were first generation. And, you know, in my family, we didn't really have money for alcohol. It wasn't a thing. But, you know, all these other kind of just like mental health, like it's generations, you know, of some kind of trauma or being kicked out or not being liked. And it just breeds this kind of like family anxiety, you know, that's very fiery and it's very passionate. But comedy is often what kind of cuts through that, you know, and allows you to be heard or seen. I don't know if that was your experience.
I don't know. I mean, I still don't know, because part of me says, oh, yeah. But then when I see comedy, it just seems to me like people are born comedians or not. Because there's a lot of people in comedy that you just say there's no through line on them other than the fact that when I talk to them, I'm like, that's a comedian. You can just something about the way they're thinking, even though it's not the way I think, but it's a comedian's way of thinking. It's really a weird thing. But I mean, I guess everything's like that. But like my younger brother, like we all played sports all the time, but my younger brother was like an athlete. Just because they move a different way and they just jump and they're faster and there's something stronger about them. And it's the same with comedians. When I talk to these comedians, I'm like, oh my God, like that's just the wrong thing to say. Why is that so funny? And they're not trying to be, like it just blurts out and you're like, oh God, we are really something wrong here, you know?
Well, Mark Maron and Jerry Seinfeld have an interview where Mark is trying to get Jerry to dissect what makes someone funny. And he's like really trying to psychoanalyze it and quantify it. And Jerry's just like, people are funny because they're funny. And Mark is just really struggles. He's like, okay, that's oversimplified. And he's like really trying. And Jerry at every point is just locking it down and just won't go there. And it sounds a little bit like your perspective too, in that, you know, Mime and I are a little bit like, well, there's people's pain and converting and like, you know, we're trying to have some formula, but fundamentally it's like you're either born with that ability to have that instinct or not.
Well, I think it can be both, but I mean, yeah, for example, like people are always like, well, you know, when they talk about comedy, they're like, they have to be speaking their opinion on some subject, but it's like, you take a guy like Mitch Hedberg, he wasn't giving his opinion on anything particularly, but he's just funny. And he's as good as anybody. Or like Steve Wright. Steve Wright is surreal. His jokes are as good as anybody. So it's like, it's so hard to, there's so many different categories of who's funny and what's funny. Well, like Don Rickles. Look at Don Rickles. His jokes were not great jokes, right? But Don Rickles be talking to any interviewer. And he's like, shut up. And you'd be like, this guy's just funny. Because there's something, he'd be like, Larry, you know, Larry King, in an interview, and give him a long question, he'd go, Larry, you're boring. Larry, you're a Jew, and nobody knows it because your last name is King, but I know it. And you're like, this guy's just funny.
Okay, wait, but there's, sorry, it's making me laugh. One of the things that I love most is watching stand-up comedy, and I've watched just about everything that exists. I'm divorced 10 years, but I dated someone after I got divorced. And when we broke up, this was, you know, several years ago, I decided to take on stand-up comedy because I was very depressed. And I at least felt like this is a distraction that doesn't involve me to follow. I don't got to follow a plot. I'm too depressed. I'm crying all the time. And the first person that I started watching was Eliza Schlesinger, which is, you know, female comedians. I could do like a whole thesis on the difference between the presentation that women have versus men. And she's more conversational. You know, she's a storyteller, whatever. Yeah. And I started watching her. And then I've kind of made it through. I mean, I watched all the things. So it's like a little bit a science for me. And I've gotten to work with some really specific comedians. Like, I worked with Woody Allen, for example, when I was 19. I did 3 episodes of Curb Your Enthusiasm. Like, I don't know who you can talk about anymore, but I'm just saying, I've worked with very, like, specific kinds of comedians. And then, you know, like, I got to hang out with, like, Jeff Garlin and Bob Saget. You know, like, I've seen those people, right, when they're not on the stage, right? It's a very different kind of funny, but there's a much more intellectual component, I think, to comedy when you are actually spending time. And I think the kind of comedy that you have moved into is much, it's deeper, you know? It's not just to make you laugh, it's to make you think and laugh, right?
Well, I like to do that kind of comedy, but that doesn't make it, in my opinion, that's just what I'm into.
Right.
But that doesn't make it more valid than, like, you know, I keep saying Mitch Hedberg, but I'm saying Mitch Hedberg is hilarious. So it's kind of a, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, I like intellectual comedy myself, but there's definitely, like, Don Rickles is not intellectual. Who's funnier than Don Rickles? I mean, who's funnier than Joan Rivers or Rodney Dangerfield? These people, I guess if I really articulate, I could think it through, but some people, you're just like, I don't know why. You know, these people are so funny. And if you read their jokes, if somebody else did their jokes, they would not be as funny because there's just something in them. And speaking of Seinfeld, he always used to say that on his show.
Yes.
He goes, we would cast people. He goes, we wouldn't know what. We'd just go, and there's something funny about that person. Find a way to use it.
And that's very, you know, I don't mean to sound old at 46. That feels very old Hollywood because that was the kind of thing that we were cultivating, right? So I was on a show from 14 to 19. I was an NBC.
I know, Blossom.
Yeah, I was, yay. Colin Quinn likes Blossom. And, you know, we were on at the same time as Seinfeld, right? And I remember that was so interesting also as a, you know, as a Jewish person, but also a comedian, like for me, my comedy is very, very, for me, it's very Jewish. Like I was raised on Jackie Mason as the gold standard of my culture, right? Because that was our guy. So for me, like when I would hear people say how much they loved Seinfeld, it was almost irritating to me because I was like, That's just how we talk. It's just how we, like, what's so funny, right?
Right.
This kind of, like, phenomenon of, like, oh, look at the Jews. Like, they're so, but they're not supposed to be Jews. We all knew they were all Jews. Like, come on. But
I agree.
What we've seen, and, like, also I was part of, you know, this era of the 90s where it's true. Someone saw my face and was like, let's put that on a little box and she's going to live in people's living rooms for the next 30 years, right? But the way that we cultivate kind of comedy now, and especially I still work in sitcom, is like, how attractive are they? What do they look like? You know, oh, they're not as funny, they're not as good, but that's the look we want, right? And I miss the old days of like, you know, of the Tracy Ullman, you know, of just throw out basically everything you would do in improv, but polish it up and then see what happens. Like I was raised on Fawlty Towers. It's like I was raised on outrageous comedy, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's also what they would do is after, because your show is, not only was it young, you were young and funny, but it was also like early, like right after grunge started.
Yeah.
So you were like this sort of like almost hipster before hipster existed. But you were like the first of this type of, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like it was a young, and then what they would do is they take somebody like you and they're like, oh, she's funny. Let's find somebody who kind of reminds me of her, even if they're not funny. Right. So they're trying to find people that sort of resemble you in some weird way. And they're like, they almost have your attitude or whatever, but instead of trying to find somebody else funny, they're like, she was funny. Let's find somebody who seems sort of like her. They'll be funny too. But it's like, it's a hobby cop.
One would hope that one day Eastern European Jewish girls will rule television.
Yes.
So once you finished high school, what was your path like? I mean, were you like, I'm going to just give this a shot? Like,
I was working in restaurants and then I quit drinking. What happened was when I quit drinking, talk about an Irish stereotype. I was so suicidal because I was like, that's the only thing I love doing, going to bars. I loved it. So I was like, now I'll do comedy because I said, I have nothing to fear. That's my biggest love of my life is gone, drinking. I have nothing to lose. Before that, I was scared of bombing.
Can we slow down what you just said? Because that's profound.
Yeah. I mean, I do feel like a lot of people go into comedy after some kind of a crisis where they're like, I don't care. There's two kinds of people going into comedy. People that are just like nervous to go into it. And people are just like, of course, the whole world should be listening to me.
Wow. I'm terrified to this day. I'm a very, very anxious, nervous performer. I am fearful. I don't do improv. I start to cry in a way that's inappropriate on stages. Yeah, it's a very interesting distinction. And I have actor friends who are absolutely fearless. I have a friend of mine, Lisa. She's a Groundlings company member. And she said some audition once came in and it said, like, you know, wear whatever you want. And if you told me that, I'd be like, well, I'm going to wear my safest outfit, jeans and a black t-shirt and Converse. And she's like, I went in silver tap pants with, you know, purple high tops and my hair in a ponytail. And I got the part. And I'm like, she's like, I looked ridiculous, but they said dress like you. And I don't have that fearlessness. So I'm so curious that alcohol was in that way. I mean, it was a crutch for whatever you felt needed to be protected. But once that was released, like, you got to be Colin.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I went back to being who I was because I was before I ever drank, I was like the class clown, big mouth. And I was like, you know, I had fun in life. I played basketball. I was around, you know, and then once I started into that, that's all I cared about. So then I get into comedy and then I was still bartending and, you know, for a couple of years, but I got lucky breaks. Like my bartending jobs were 11 the morning and afternoon, like afternoon shifts. In those days, people still drink at lunch. Yeah. So I was this afternoon, evening bartender. My spots weren't till 11 at night, so I could actually sleep a little late in the morning. It couldn't have gone better as far as what I would want. You know, it was really amazing. I was very lucky that I got a job like that, you know?
Miami Alex Breakdown is supported by Best Fiends.
I go hard with Best Fiends.
What level are you on, Miami?
I'm on level 1412. 1412. What is Best Fiends? Best Fiends is a mobile puzzle game. Anyone can download it. Anyone can play it. Whether you have a few minutes or a few hours, it is a wonderful puzzle game. It's really fun. There are all these little characters that help you solve all these puzzles. And the more you play, the more characters you have. And then the more you win, you get new challenges and you can win other things. I'm on level 1412, and I hope that there are a million levels and I want to play them all. There are thousands of levels and you can play as long as you want and never get bored. Trust me on that. I've been playing for years. Download Best Fiends free today. This is a free experience that you can partake in. I love it. Go to the App Store, Google Play. That is Friends Without the R, Best Fiends. See how long it takes you to get to level 1412.
Miami B. Alex Breakdown is supported by Relief Band.
What am I anxious about these days? I think the better question is, what am I not anxious about? Because it feels like that would be a much shorter list. I recommend checking out Relief Band. It's the number one FDA-cleared anti-nausea wristband that has been clinically proven to quickly relieve and effectively prevent anxiety-induced nausea and vomiting. Relief Band works by stimulating a place in the wrist, a nerve in the wrist, that travels to part of the brain that controls nausea that is caused by anxiety or can be caused by other ailments. It essentially blocks the signal that your brain is sending to your stomach, telling you you do not feel well. I have a kid who gets sick in the car. That's who the Relief Band goes to in our house. Relief Band makes a great gift for any time of the year. And right now they have an exclusive offer just for our listeners. Go to reliefband.com, use promo code BREAKDOWN, and you'll get 20% off plus free shipping and a no questions asked 30-day money back guarantee. That's the best offer that you'll find for Relief Band anywhere, but you've got to use our code. Go to reliefband.com, use the promo code BREAKDOWN for 20% off plus free shipping.
So I did comedy and I just was in love with it. You know, I loved it so much that I was like, this is the greatest gig in the world. Even though it was harder then to write material. It was so hard. Like now I could at least write, like, you know, like if the Ukraine happens, I'm like, okay, I'm trying to write and things come out. In those days, it was so hard to write jokes. I can't even believe I stayed in.
Was it finding your voice? Like, what is it like?
Jokes.
Yeah.
I believe your voice is going to come over when it comes over, but writing the material, your voice comes through the material. You know what I mean? So It's like voice to me. If it's just finding your voice, people that do that, it's like posturing to me. You know what I mean? Like it works, but I'm just saying to me, it's posturing. Like I'm about the content. What are you saying? Where's the jokes? You know what I mean? No matter, like I said, if it's, I like to talk about cerebral stuff, but it doesn't matter. What are your jokes? Because sometimes somebody be up there and you're like, you're just eating up people's time. Get to the jokes. Doesn't matter if it's the deepest, profound thing. What are you up there? Because I feel like a danger for comedians, for everybody to show up as comedians, is to try to be, you know, to try to be like the voice, the conscience of a nation and all that stuff. And it's like, you're not that deep. You know what I mean? If you had answers, if anybody had answers, forget comedians, we'll know about it.
Okay, wait, but that's funny coming, not funny, that's unusual coming from you, because you are a person who, in a way that I tremendously appreciate, has decided to combine some of the largest concepts, you know, that,
right,
that we
but
can tackle.
Jokes first.
No,
thank you.
Absolutely. Absolutely jokes first. And also second.
No, thank you.
But what, and I know there's like a long way between, you know, high school and college and that, but, you know, is it that when you're a young, you know, comedian or starting out, that it's about kind of like finding that voice and finding who you are? And then with maturity, you then get to be like, I'm going to tackle politics.
No, because back then I tried to do the same concepts. You know what I mean? And in fact, I've actually had a couple of little lines from those days that I found a place to put it. But you know, you just don't know. You don't know how, it's like anything else. You don't know where to put it. So you're sitting there going, and you're on stage and the crowd's not laughing. And you're like, oh, that whole thing must be terrible. It's like, no, you don't understand. That's not just a punchline. It's presentation. So if I'm going to say something like, let's say I'm doing, I wish I could think of a routine particularly, but if I'm doing any routine and let's say I was talking about the Ukraine or something, you know? So if I jump right into Putin is this way.
Right.
People are like, whoa, 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 what are you saying?
Right.
We're not going to laugh at a joke. You didn't put us in the right. But if you take too long and go, here's what's going on with Russia. First of all, right. And then you're taking too long. People are like, okay, you know, TED Talk, what they call a TED Talk, you know? So it's like finding the place where you're like, I'm bringing you in to where I think the humor is, and then I'm getting to it. So it's like a weird fine line.
Okay,
you know?
So I really, really love the way you speak, first of all. And what you're describing is a kind of processing. I don't have the same process because we do different things. But there's a certain sense, like even in the work that I do, right? Even on a sitcom, right? There is this, and I worked with Chuck Lorre for 10 years, who, like, you know, he knows what to do with the sitcom, right? It's not rocket science, but he has figured it out, you know, for the most part, in terms of, and look, you don't have to like sitcom. I don't really love sitcom in terms of those rhythms, but they work for a reason and they work in our brains as a species.
Yeah,
right?
And like anything else, when they're good, they're good.
Right. So this is what I was going to say. There's a sense of the rhythm of a joke or of a sensibility. And, you know, for me, I come from like people who sold cigarettes on the street in villages with no electricity. Like that's my immediate story is like my grandparents were sweatshop workers who barely spoke English on my mom's side.
Right.
Like we think my mom peed in a bucket because there was no plumbing for some years. So like that's my story. And then on my dad's side, like they were the, you know, assimilated, you know, Jewish New Yorkers. My grandfather worked in the Empire State Building as an accountant. Like, oh, he made it in America. He was an accountant, right? And what I've discovered is that this sense that I have, like this knowing, you know, it's almost like, you know, if a shoe fits, you know, when you put on a shoe, yes. And it's like, it's just like, it's not right. That's what it feels. It feels wrong to me when comedy's wrong. And it annoys certain people because many people want to be like, just like, it's funny enough, like it's okay. But it's almost like, you know, and I am on the obsessive compulsive spectrum, so I also have a physiological feeling I get when something's wrong. But I get it in comedy, like when the timing is off, it's almost like if you're hitting a C and it should be a B, like it's wrong. And I'm wondering, you know, obviously I have great reverence for Irish culture and literature. And I was raised in particular with a lot of Irish poetry, and my, like, James Joyce is on my dad's gravestone. Like, it's a whole thing. But I'm wondering, like, do you think this is just something that, like, Colin got, like, in the genetic, you know, in the genetic roulette that is your life? Like, you got three siblings, right? And did you just get this? Like, it's just, you got it, whatever that is?
Whatever that part is. But they're all, like my brothers and sisters and my cousins are all, like, funny, like, in a, like, I feel like there's a certain Irish mentality that there's a humor, like Jewish humor. Yeah. There's an Irish personality, like, that's funny. There's something about, well, I mean, like, humor in general is one of the big, you know, obviously generalization, but is your angle on things. So if I'm talking about Putin, what's my angle that's going to be so funny? You know what I mean? And same thing with Jews, Irish people, Black people. What's your angle on this? And so with Irish people, there's just this, I don't know what it is, but it's a very corner of the mouth kind of attitude that just makes me laugh.
Well,
where they're just like, yeah, you know. And my friend once did, my friend Harry O'Reilly, who's a actor, very funny guy. And one time when I first met him, he grew up in Marine Park, Brooklyn, with an Irish thing too. And he goes, what about these guys? He goes, you go to them, hey man, I really feel like, you know, my girlfriend, like, we're broken up, but I'd like to get back together. And he goes like this. And I just laughed for like 10 minutes where he just goes, so many guys used to do that to you.
Yeah.
You're in the middle of something personal, they go.
And for people who are only
People who are only listening,
Colin has just opened his mouth and said absolutely nothing.
Right. It's hard to explain.
Yeah. Thanks for, you know, basically saying, yeah, nobody cares. Yeah. What he's saying is, yes, it's so precise if you're really interested in OCD like we are, but it's precise. And when it's not, you want to go, how can you be so funny and then just throw that part away? That's what drives you crazy. These are professionals. They've done it before, and now they don't care to try to repeat that level.
I was raised in Los Angeles, but I was raised by very recent transplants. Like, my mom was 9 months pregnant when they moved. They were living in Manhattan at the time. And I was raised, you know, I was raised to speak like a New Yorker. I was corrected for my pronunciation. Like, I was taught that the word quarter is water with a Q. Like, that's how you say, and I was corrected and admonished. And, you know, I say they raised me like it was the 40s in L.A. We played hit the penny. We played stickball. Like, I don't know why they raised me like we were in a tenement house. Right. I mean, it was close where I grew up, you know, with. Anyway. But what I was going to say is there's something very specific about New York people. And in particular, and I say this, you know, you are a very special person and a very special comedian. You can meet people that look like this guy. And that talk like this guy, and they're in policeman uniforms, and they're standing on the corner, like they're walking their beat, and they talk like this. Like, you can meet, like, you meet firefighters that you think should have a stand-up show, and it's, they're not comedians. There's a sensibility in particular to this kind of, this era of Brooklyn, and also, you know, Irish Brooklyn and kind of Irish New York in particular, but, like, just to imagine, there's, like, there's a whole country of Ireland, and like, I wonder, are they like that? Like, why aren't they like us there?
Well, they're more, Irish people are really funny. I mean, they're another level of funny. Like, every comedian that goes to Ireland goes, I love the Irish people, because they just put you in your place. Like, they just don't like anybody. I'm sure everybody feels that way about the people, but they don't like anybody getting too, like, too big. And
yeah,
but there's just something very funny. But anyway, it doesn't matter. But I mean, yeah, there's something in, or at least New York, the way, I mean, I did a whole show on New York personality, New York story. I took about the Jews, the Irish, and all the different groups. And so I analyzed it all down. But there's something in New York, I feel like, that made people a certain way. Maybe because they had to hit the ground running.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, but it was a definite sensibility.
It's post-Depression era. It's post a lot of pogroms. It's post-Holocaust. Like, the comedy, even, and that rippled out to the other communities. Like, my family in Queens, like, I have family in Flushing, where everybody sounds like Fran Drescher. The women sound like Fran Drescher, the men. And that is some of the most hilarious parts of, and they're teachers, they're housewives. These are not special, like, celebrity people.
Right, but they're just fun.
They're freaking hilarious, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
So I'm curious also, you know, you got married later in life, correct?
Well, I was married before, but yeah.
Right. But you recently are in a relationship.
Yeah.
What was it like being a comedian dating? Like, I know it's a crazy lifestyle and, you know, obviously not drinking is probably less fun dating than drinking. I don't know.
Well, I got used to it fairly early, so it wasn't. But yes, it's a different ballgame, but, you know.
Yeah.
What's it like? I mean, you know, it's obviously easier than it is for most people because you're around people all the time. Right. So, you know, girls will be like, hey, they can come up to you and go, I like your show. So there's already an icebreaker going on.
For men, there is. Ali Wong's recent special, I'm going to talk about this forever. She says when men become famous and have power and respect, like, they're dating models and, you know, they get all the, she uses a much more vulgar word about the fan attention they get. And she said for women, it's like the prospects go down and it's mostly stalkers. Like, it's not, when a woman gets power and respect, she said it's a very different game. I think for comedians, you know, Chelsea Handler talked about this. Eliza, Sarah Silverman's talked about it with us, you know.
Right. Well, I guess it is for them, yeah.
Right.
There's also a difference on perspective. Mm-hmm. So they call them stalkers. We wouldn't care.
What does Eliza Schlesinger say? It's only sexual harassment if he's not attractive. Sorry, it's terrible. She said it first, not me.
I know, but that's the kind of humor that
right.
is funny because, you know, when you go to see comedy, you used to expect a certain kind of what, you know what I mean, like, transgress, you know,
right.
And so now people are just worried, you know.
Yeah,
well, yeah, that part of comedy is like,
well, yeah. So I guess tell us about sort of your what you consider, I guess, your break.
Well, I've had several breaks, and I've sabotaged a lot of them. If you want to talk about mental health, I mean, I was on MTV. That was my big break, and then after that, it was like nothing. So I was on MTV. So
tell people what you did on MTV. I mean, I grew up when MTV first started. So
it was a game show and I was like the sidekick, but it was very big in late 80s. I mean, we would go down the streets in Midtown or wherever we were and be flooded with like 80 kids and everybody over 23 would go, who are they? We didn't know who we were. It was the weirdest thing. You'd walk in one store, people over 23, they didn't know who you were. Under 23, they go, the Beatles, you know? And then so it was crazy, you know? So then I get all these opportunities to be auditioned for TV shows. So I walked in there. You know, when I walked in, you would have thought, speaking about mental illness, you would have thought if it was today, it would have been like, when I entered, you would have thought Martin Scorsese, Leonardo DiCaprio, and like Oliver Stone entered the room. That's how I used to walk in, like, they would ask me, what do you think of our script? I go, it's terrible. I'll fix it for you. Me and my comedy friends will fix it for you.
So how'd that go over?
I made more enemies just by being an ass. And I would sit there, and in those days, I would be smoking. It's like 1990. And I'm in there. I'm on MTV. I think I'm a comedian, big shot comedian. You know what I mean? And I'm just in there, like, talking to these guys, like, yeah, now you know who's in charge of me. So it ended up very badly. But anyway, cut to a few years later, I'm broke. I'm living on my friend's couch.
You're living on your friend's couch?
No, not only on my friend's couch. I had to live back with my mother. So
this is what happens when you don't become a cop, like your cousin.
Yes, yeah. Right. So I'm sitting there and I'm like, you know, and then I get on my friend gives me a writing job on SNL. So then that, and then after that, it was more or less a different story, at least because my stand-up was developed. My problem was when I was on MTV, my stand-up wasn't developed. So I wasn't a strong stand-up. So I couldn't really just keep doing stand-up. It wasn't working that well. So I was doing it, but I wasn't, you know, getting gigs because I would bomb so much. And so that got in the way of my development, but it was a good lesson for me in some ways, you know.
And how was your time? I mean, I know it's like it's its own, you know, topic, and I'm not looking for gossip or anything, but generally speaking, what was your time like? You know, I mean, SNL is, I mean, this is, you know, extremely iconic and important, you know, aspect of
the best of times, it was the worst of times. Right. You know what I mean? It was It was the, I mean, we all went in there at the beginning of a fresh slate, and everybody, I can only speak for myself. I brought my dreams, expectations, attitude problems, you know, defenses and everything else there. So that's what I brought. So it went great. And we, you know, there were people, we loved each other. Like any dynamic, things happen. And, you know, it took me years to realize my part. And that's the only part I could really speak to. Although, you know, obviously we all like to speak to everybody's, but I would say I definitely knew how to sabotage pretty well. You know, some things I've done that I would not call sabotage. I would say I did what was for the right reasons. That was not one of them. I would say I had a lot of issues that I didn't realize, and it came out when it came the way it came out. You know.
Well, this feels like a good time to ask. You know, stopping drinking or whatever it is that you know. I mean, you know, we fill it with whatever. Meaning, you can be a workaholic. You know, a lot of people stop drinking and take up, you know, being a full time, you know, manager and controller, which is my favorite thing to be.
Sure.
But I'm curious, did you have like support around stopping drinking? Did you do 12-step? Did you go to therapy?
I don't really talk about 12-step stuff. I'm like real old school. I will say I did not do it on my own. Yeah.
Okay, got it. You know, as someone who I've spoken openly about, you know, I sit in three different rooms. I've sat in three different rooms in the past 20 years. And so I live my life according to kind of the big book and the traditions and principles. And one of the things, and this is not to specifically talk about 12 steps, but one of the things that I've learned is that when you put down the thing, then you find out why you were picking up the thing, you know? So like the expression, like, if you want to find out why you're using, stop using. That's true of food. It's true of alcohol. It's true of sex. It's true of pot. It's true of other narcotics. But it's also true of obsessing, controlling, codependency, seeking validation. So what happens is when we stop doing that thing, like, we're left just with us, you know? So I guess I'm curious, like, making a decision to stop whatever it was that we were doing.
Yeah.
It's then it's like, okay, now you just have like the rest of your life to manage without the thing that made it so much easier. So I guess I'm curious, like, is that sort of just this process that keeps unfolding for you? Like, oh, look, I can still be obstinate. I could still be whatever, self, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, I'll just speak. My thing was, and I'm sure it was no secret to people that were close to me, because I felt like I was very stealth, because people would say, you're so like normal, you're so down to earth, you know, even though you're doing well in the business. My ego, I was good at playing it off. My ego was so deep, I didn't even have to play it up. That's how deep it was. But I didn't know that, you know. Or if I knew it, I thought it was cute.
Right.
And then years later, I go, oh, no.
So how do you realize that? Like, how did you realize that?
Pain.
Right.
Only pain. That was it.
Yeah.
Pain. That's the only way I realized it. Maybe other people could figure it out, but I never realized anything until it hurt me. You know? And then I'm like, wait a minute. Now it's serious. Now it's affecting me.
Right. And do you like therapy? Do you meditate? Are you a meditator?
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know. I mean, I've been slacking off on meditation lately.
Mm-hmm.
Meditation's fine. I mean, it's good. There's good things in it. But again, it's one of those things where I can make even meditation all about, when it's all about me, it's all about me.
Yep.
And that's one of my biggest, as you know, that's one of the biggest things is, you know, it's like the old expression, I may not be much, but I'm all I think about.
I totally get that, because I'm a person who, I'm a competitive yoga person, meaning you're supposed to go to yoga to like center and all these things. And first of all, in LA, in my defense, walking into a yoga studio in LA, it might as well be like a Sports Illustrated swimsuit photo shoot you were not invited to and that you showed up at, like, and they think you're bringing craft service. Okay. So that in and of itself is a challenge. But for me, like, you know, I was raised very athletic, very, you know, shake it off, get up, you know, faster, harder. Like, I was raised like that. So for me, like, it is all of, and that is, that's ego, you know, that's better than less than. I'm constantly scanning, which as an actor is, and as a woman in particular, a female actor, very, very challenging, you know, for that kind of ego conflict. But no, I so relate to that, because also that's, I'm also finding like all these defects that they've been hiding. I thought they were gone because like they weren't as prominent. And I was like, oh, you morphed into this other shitty part of myself.
It's like
hiding. It was hiding. And I keep finding it. It makes me feel icky.
Yes, I agree 100%. It's like, it's so subtle and it's just there, you know.
What was therapy like for you? Like, I think you're a tough guy. Like, what's it like when we put you in a therapist's office?
Therapy was like, I've had therapists, different therapists, but I got a male this time because I need a male therapist for this, you know? And then we had these, I mean, I literally would just be like, you know, have confrontations with him all the time because I didn't realize therapy, where it was just, he would just look at me and it used to make me so mad, you know? And just be like, and I just felt like he was looking at me with this, like, I just felt like, and I would tell him, I go, are you looking at me to provoke me, or is it because you're stupid and you really have nothing to say? So you're just sitting there hoping something accidentally comes to you, you know, or something, you know, hits me a certain way. I go, am I supposed to project onto you because you actually are empty? So then I'll be doing all the work. Like I used to resent it so much. But also he was kind of, you know, he had his own attitude, which I needed. I felt, you know, but it took me a few years to really appreciate the fact that he was saying, look, I mean, the short version is there's only one asshole me and you can do anything about around here. That's you. You're paying so we can fix one dickhead. And it's not somebody outside this world. You don't pay so we can fix the world. So I was like, you know, it's one of those lessons you keep learning. And you just keep learning in different forms, you know?
Well, and I think also, like they say, you do with your therapist what you do with everyone. Also, I'm just picturing, like, if I were on the therapist side of it, the fact that, like, me looking at someone might cause them to say those things. It's like, oh, this person came in with a lot of, like, a little bit of a chip on his shoulder.
Well, because when my friend turned me on to him and goes, this guy's a Jungian therapist. Mm. So I said, this is going to be great. It's going to be this symbolic journey with all these symbols. And really, it was just like somebody going to me like, yeah, you said you did this, but then you did this. And I'm like, what? So what? Where's my, you know what I mean? Like, where's the shadow fucking mysterious shit that I want to learn here? You know?
Sorry. I'm sure he was thinking about the shadow mysterious shit.
Oh, I brought it up to him too. I go, where's the fucking, you know, like after like a year, I go, where's like the Jungian? I go, what's Jungian about this? He goes, do you know a lot about Jungian therapy? I go, well, but I guess a Jung book. I go, what the fuck? I don't see any of that stuff. He goes, that's not what this is. I go, but you're the big Jungian therapist.
You're like, if I pay extra, can you write up some shadow shit for me?
Because I wanted that to be like, quote unquote, the drug, where I'd be like, walking around in this mystical state. And he used to tell me, this is it. He goes, this is all there is in life. Mm. He goes, this is it. He goes, there's nothing coming that you think, you know what I mean? Because I had that, I wanted delusion, you know, anything to get out of, you know, boring life. When I was a little kid, I used to hate being bored so much. I used to just sit there and go, this is misery. Just sitting there with nothing going on. I was like, I used to hate to go in like the country. I hated the country because I was like, oh, God, because everybody talks like takes 10 minutes. And everything's very slow. And then you're waiting for the comment and you're like, holy shit. And then so I wanted life to be, you know, I wanted it to be like a yacht, like a Coke filled yacht, you know. I wanted to be in this endless party, you know?
So I'd like Jonathan to weigh in here because also, so Jonathan is an East Coaster, you know, by knowing someone from Toronto, I was like, oh, look, an East Coaster, but they're not like New Yorkers. And John,
no,
Jonathan
they have
has
humility.
They
have, yeah, I know. Toronto's a whole different ballgame.
And it's like does his speech pattern remind you of me a little bit?
Oh, for sure. I mean, there's an impatience there that's tangible. I'm curious how long it took from the realization of, oh, this is all there is to like realize, you know, like how did that go from there? Did you settle into that a little bit? Did you fight it? What was the process?
Yeah, I mean, I'll still fight it, you know, unless I catch myself, I'll fight it, of course, you know. But I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, it's devastating, but then you're like, oh, you know, like what the imaginary world that somehow I conjured up in my head. Yeah. I remember when I was a little kid watching these like Matt Helm movies with Dean Martin and going, that's the world I want to live in. It was like 9 years old. Like, that's the life, you know. Just everybody drinking and smoking and partying, you know what I mean? That was it.
You have a line in Red State, Blue State where you say, we've met the enemy and it's us. And you mean it about, you know, the problems in the U.S. But I listened to that recently and I was like, oh, that's also very much about our internal process as human beings just to be happy. The difference between our expectations, like we want the yacht versus what actually is.
Even the idea of being happy is kind of an expectation. You know what I mean? The word happy is a bad setup. Instead of just being, you know, being whatever it is. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, I want to be happy. It's like, that's already going to be who's walks around all happy, especially nowadays. People are miserable. Mm. You know what I mean? Only happy people are like, you know, just crazy people. But we used to know that, I guess. And now people don't. Yeah. Did you ever see Lovers and Other Strangers? It's a great movie from the 60s, late 60s, early 70s.
Mm-mm.
The parents are talking to the kid. He goes, we're not happy. He goes, and the father goes, they're older. He goes, who's happy? He goes, you think your mother and I are happy? And he goes, you're not happy? He goes, and they look at each other. They go, no. And then they look at each other. They go, we're content.
Yeah.
We're content. But and the mother is Bea Arthur, by the way, and she's great. And the father is Richard Castellano. But it's a great movie. But you know, trying to be happy is one of the biggest problems in the world.
Move the goalpost from happy to generally content.
Yeah,
I try and aim for serenity, whatever that looks like. You know, meaning like even if there is unhappiness, there's got to be a place that inside of me. That I can, you know, tap into. Are you a religious person? Like, do you believe in God? Are you spiritual? Was your family?
I believe in God, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's that like?
Believing in God?
Yeah. Like,
well, I mean, it's like I look at everything and I just go, I guess this is how it's supposed to be.
That's a great definition of what it's like to believe in God.
Yeah. And I just go, okay, I guess so, you know, I don't know. I mean, and like, I believe in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
That's just how it is. I don't know why, but I just believe in all that stuff.
Is there a hell too?
I believe in hell, totally. And I believe in purgatory. I believe in the middle section.
Right. I'm Jewish, so walk me through this.
Well, like purgatory would be like where you're kind of in the waiting list for heaven, but you have a lot of things, a lot of explaining to do, as they used to say. You're not a hell person. You're not like a rapist or a murderer or whatever. You know what I mean? But at the same time, you know, some of you're not going to waltz into heaven. So heaven, you have to be in a state of grace.
Got it.
You know how hard it is to be in a state of grace? And Catholicism lets a lot of people off the hook. I don't think I need to tell that to the world, but...
Sorry. Jokes about how they made a career of letting people off the hook, as a matter of fact. Okay, sorry.
That's correct. Yeah. But I mean, so it's basically, you know, just in between. You have a little cool your heels for a couple of thousand years.
So you can get in eventually?
You can get in eventually.
Got it. Hold on. Where do the Jews go?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not really a Catholic.
Okay.
I'm more of a, You know, I've almost formulated my own religion in many ways.
Okay. Yeah. I can dig that. Yeah. I'd love to ask kind of one more thing, before we end. So, I guess I'd like a feeling of a little bit of a, I mean, I feel like there's so many aspects of your career that really feel so, at least for me as an observer, very gratifying, for the path that you've had, especially starting at MTV, like, you know, when it was like this, you know, essentially new kind of medium to, you know, making a presence for yourself on one of, you know, the most iconic kind of comedy platforms, you know, that exist for us. And then really building, you know, then your own career, your own voice. And you got married. Was it before COVID? Are you one of those people who got married during COVID?
Right before COVID. Yeah. Like a year, like, I don't know how long before COVID, maybe a year.
You can lie to us or we can cut this out. Like, what's it like to be married? Are you a happy married comedian at this point in life?
First of all, if I wasn't, I would lie anyway and say I was. What am I going to say? It's suffocating.
Maybe this is where you want to unleash all of your we could bring her on. We could do a session.
No, yeah, she's a totally different personality from me, but she's great. Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, we got along great during the pandemic. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was definitely one of those things where you're like, oh boy, this is a good test.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it was really, it was a great into the fire type moment.
Right. That's really, it's very sweet. It's such a pleasure to talk to you. It's really, it's so neat, you know, to get to hear your voice, you know, because obviously you are a very natural speaker in your work, but it's just really so great to get to hear from you. Colin Quinn, thank you so much. This has been really, really awesome. It's really fun. We really appreciate it. And we wish you all good things.
Thanks. Same here, man. Hopefully we'll do it again.
Absolutely. Yeah, we didn't get into so many things. So yes, lots more. Thank you. I'm meeting more of my people by doing Miami Alex Breakdown than ever before.
Maybe we only have New York guests.
I mean, I just feel so comfortable when someone talks, like when someone speaks like that.
Also, I think you had more jokes this episode than any
other. Making a comedian laugh, it's like, I had him laughing hard. He left frame a couple times.
I was watching you perform here, and I was like, oh, she's got some real comedy chops that
performing,
I didn't know about.
I was just being, Jonathan.
Normally, you're not that funny. I'll be honest.
It's like, do you work here? Can you clean the bathroom, please? Someone threw up. That's what it's like going to yoga in LA.
Well, this is what I'm saying, is that you have said that story multiple times on the podcast. You 100% got a punch up between the last time you told that story, and it's all because of the New York energy?
Yeah,
tell me.
So it's, there is a place, you know, there's a place in our brains that, you know, kind of get activated that way when we're in more of a it's a linguistic flow, it's a rhythmic flow. I mean, it's like when you and I riff really hard, you know, which nobody gets to see, it's our own private riffing. But when you and I riff really hard and it's like, it's that rolling sense of timing and laughter. And, you know, it's so funny also when you meet non-Jewish New Yorkers who do the same thing as Jewish New York. Like, that's what people say. It's like Italians are like, it's all the same for that kind of New York energy, you know? And the thing that I really like is like, that is a straight shooter personality. Like if he wasn't having a good time, it would have been quite evident. So for me, then when I say something that might be less funny, like that's the desire. And it's like, if you think of it, like if we were primates in the wild, like what is it? I want to be my, you know, best funny self to try and match it, you know?
Well, we mirror the language of other people around them. Like, I used to go to Montreal to be with my brother-in-law's family, and then, like, all of a sudden, I would have a French accent, and I'm talking like this.
That's weird.
and like, all the time, and it's just because there's research, I don't have it, but there's research that we mimic the speech patterns of the people around us so that we feel better understood.
You don't need to have research. That's just like a thing that everyone knows.
I mean, there's real studies.
Okay,
about
but it's
it,
okay if there's not.
So
we know that.
Don't
true.
Take my word for it. Anytime I say things, you're like, that's not scientific. Now I'm saying there's science behind it, and you're like, you don't need science.
Everything you say, there's research that I'm happy today. No, when you speak to your family, your Canadian accent becomes, you know, heavier, and you use use different expressions. I mean, people say when I speak to my mom, it sounds like a different language.
Like, you start to sound like a baby goat.
Nah. My very first boyfriend, I was very young. He was from Westchester County. I don't know if that counts, but if you know where Westchester is, maybe you're laughing, or maybe you're deeply insulted.
That's like a New York joke. That's like, it's not really New York because it's Westchester.
He was from a fancier neighborhood, let's say. And like, you know, like, yeah. Anyway, no, I've dated West Coasters, Midwesterner. That's a whole experience. Like, you were like, your speech is rapid compared to the Midwest. And my ex-husband was, you know, Southern, but raised in, you know, the Bay. I mean, his family's Southern, but raised in the Bay. I think that would be very interesting. In all seriousness, gosh, what a story. It's a really good Hollywood story of like this kid who, like, that's all he thought to do. He just wanted to party, have fun, and he was funny. And then he like built a life around that. And that's his career.
I don't want to party. I just want to have fun and play. And now I'm sitting in this chair with you.
No, but honestly, there were certain things he said about his teen experience that sounded like what you've talked about. Like, really, like, I don't want to say wanting to be somewhere else, but like, you know, you had really great times at like summer camp and like working, you know, with young people. And like, you know, I am not a person who's ever said like, I want a lifestyle that just feels like I'm at camp all the time. Like, that's never appealed to me at all.
So when I was in high school, actually junior high too, like I would do okay, pretty well in school, like mid B's, even A's for pretty much from like September until May hit. And as soon as May hit in Toronto, it got so nice outside, I just was like, could not participate in any type of education.
September to May, that's pretty good.
Things took a really big dive at the end, though. I was just like, I hit my wall and I was done.
I really also love how he talks about, you know, kind of sobriety, and it's a very specific type of drinker, you know, the one that he described. That's the one is too much and all the drinks in the world are never enough kind. I thought that was really interesting the way he described it, you know, that he kind of always knew what that was serving. And then it, you know, ceased to serve him, as it were. I want to remind people that he is doing a tour of his new show, Colin Quinn, The Last Best Hope. He was just wrapped a New York run. And you can go to colinquinn.com to get tickets. And I think he might be our last best hope. It was really, really exciting to talk to him.
If anyone listening hasn't watched Red State, Blue State, or if they haven't watched A New York Story, I was rewatching a little bit of The New York Story. The New York Story. He has a bit about when Jews come over and they're the first organizers of unions. It's not that they're complaining, but they just want to know if it could be done better. It was very, very funny. Had me laughing.
I'm eager to rewatch. Well, I think that was just really, really awesome. And, you know, that's our second SNL person we've had on.
That's right. Yeah. We've had two. We got into more of the psychology with Bobby. If you want more SNL content.
More SNL Irish content.
There's lots of stuff in there, in that library of ours.
All right. From our breakdown to the one we hope you never have, we'll see you next time.
It's my Bialik breakdown. She's going to break it down for you. She's got a neuroscience PhD or two. One fiction, one fact. And now she's going to break down.